Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel like I'm knocking on heaven's door.
By the middle of 1846, winter quarters, although intended to be a temporary halfway house to Zion, was a fully functioning settled town, sort of. Remember that it had no charter and no official status under federal or state jurisdiction, which meant it was sort of a squishy, lawless territory with no real accountability. Around 3,500 people at the time, give or take the fluctuating incoming and outgoing wagon companies, it hosted around 600 cabins, according to a census taken in 1846, several mills, a school, and stores. And for the Mormons in the room, it was also divided into wards, averaging around 13 wards and 22 wards at its height.
Outside of winter quarters proper, there's about 7,000 other saints and little encampments all over Iowa on both sides of the Missouri River. Indian treaties be damned, we're gonna just plop ourselves here. The Mormons were divided into Brigham Young's favorite way to organize, the block system. Very geometric and orderly. The settlement was kind of like the love child of Salt Lake City and Nauvoo, because running north and south, you've got 1st and 2nd Main. Then running east and west, kind of like Nauvoo, you had streets named Cutler, Cahoon, Pratt, Woodruff, Russell, Smith. No Young. Thought that was interesting. Each of the blocks was then divided into 20 equal lots. Marie Kondo would have been so proud. Like older Marie Kondo, not like today's Marie Kondo, but I digress.
You have kids, it messes up your streets, we get it. And it's the orderly part we're going to focus on in today's episode. And this episode was inspired by a fantastic article, one of my favorites about winter quarters, Law and Order in Winter Quarters by Edward L. Kimball and Kenneth W. Godfrey, published in the Journal of Mormon History in the spring volume 32. And we're going to link it in the show notes because it is worth the read.
The article title basically sums up the topic of how law and order were needed in winter quarters.
I know, sweet baby Mormon loves. We like to think of our Mormon ancestors as cooperative, earnest, hardworking people who work together like busy little bees with no conflict. And that's a true perspective. If you descended from Avatar robots, not people. But I don't know about you, my ancestors were human beings with lots of big human feelings, little skills and resources that allowed healthy exploration of those feelings, and they had a lot of very difficult challenges. All that gobbledygook is to say that Mormons had problems just like everyone else, and in many cases, created more problems for themselves with their choices.
You mean to say that people who have experienced a lot of community trauma and discrimination, abandoned their wealth at the hands of injustice, camped illegally on Indian land in the middle of a muddy swamp, aren't happy all the time?
And yet, grid system, we are orderly. And Mormons like to organize ourselves into nice, orderly little hierarchies. Today's episode is going to discuss how we dealt with the issues of being human under some pretty extraordinary circumstances, and also some pretty ordinary ones too. How did Mormons during this period deal with conflict? It's worth exploring, and today we dive into it all. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Before any diving, however, first a word from our friends at Signature Books. Plural marriage in the Nauvoo era of LDS church history has long been a fascinating subject. To understand it fully requires one to look at it from the perspective of the man who introduced it, but just as crucial is a dive into the lives of the women he married, all who have their stories to tell. In his 1997 award-winning study, In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, Todd Compton focused on the 33 women who he could demonstrate that Smith married, providing life stories of many who are well-known and others who have been largely forgotten. In his new work, In Sacred Loneliness, The Documents, Compton returns to his subject and provides the raw materials that helped him create his original study, writings composed by the women themselves. This volume includes many autobiographical writings, diaries, and letters, with Compton providing annotations and introductory material that illuminates these crucial primary sources. This allows readers to take their understanding of this unique group of women to a new level, and to drive home the fact that their lives go far beyond the Nauvoo experiment that forever links them to Mormonism's founding prophet. In Sacred Loneliness, The Documents, by Todd Compton. Published by Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books or some lonelier place.
Do not get it from James Emmett's camp out in the wilderness.
You'll just have to give your book back to him.
All right. To understand the next century of Mormon history, this episode is going to be pretty foundational. Do you hear me? Pretty foundational, which means you'll have to listen to it at least 5 times, give us at least 5-star reviews, and leave a nice comment on iTunes for us. We don't go down all these rabbit holes just to find random benign facts about Mormon history to bore you with. Well, sometimes we do. But every episode we choose is deliberately and strategically crafted and chosen to help you build up your own knowledge of differing interacting parts of the Mormon system, because our hope is that it not only invites you into the Mormon historical conversation, but as you learn different puzzle pieces, you'll be able to come to conclusions that might add to our understanding of the historical conversation and context. What I'm basically saying is, we're doing Mormon history, and you can too.
Now, it might seem boring on its face, but the legal parts of how Mormonism work are actually really important. We've shown you in Nauvoo how Mormons like Joseph Smith and company interact with the law. You can't understand the Joseph Smith story without understanding how his relationship with the legal system shaped everything.
And this winter quarters period is no different. Here's a simplified understanding. Mormons are like everyone else in the Wild West, except they operate under their own self-imposed form of government and legal system. And if you don't understand the legal system, you're going to develop a sort of warped outtake of the stories in Mormonism. I remember when Will Bagley told me about the importance of learning about the military strategy of the Mormons. And my mind went, yawn, war stuff is boring. Because to me, war history was something male nerd historians did, like playing toy soldiers. But that was kind of an idiotic, immature viewpoint, honestly. And I'm so glad that Bagley gave me that advice. As I've dived heavy into the Utah period, I'm grateful over and over and over again that I started to understand the formation and strategies behind Mormon military. I really can't tell you how useful that advice has been.
It's exactly the same with the Mormon system of governance. Please, please, please don't dismiss the stuff as boring. Learn it, get a grasp on it, and if you do, the world will open up to you. When we get into the Utah period, and it's 1857, suddenly you'll see more clearly why people make the choices they do. When we're in 1860s southern Utah, and we're wondering why this plural wife doesn't just tell her jerk husband to stick it, you'll better understand the framework of her choices. When we talk about divorce and polygamy, you'll be able to picture why people made the decisions they did. When the manifesto history comes up, you'll say, all right, I get why this certain elder said such and such to the congregation. This is what he was going for. All of this comes back to this new culture that's forming in the Mormon governance.
And we can't, by decree of Heavenly Father himself, talk about Mormon legal stuff without bringing in King and Magistrate Russet himself, John Dinger, who I imagine right now just drove into town to buy a bunch of snacks at King's, and they got home real fast to help us record this podcast.
We are bringing in the big guns, legal expert and a criminal defense prosecutor himself, on top of being an excellent historian. John Dinger is going to explain the legal system during this time period and why it matters.
Now what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say goodbye.
Okay, well, we want to welcome back John Dinger. We've been teasing it, and now we have one of the experts on extra legal justice, structure, any sort of military or police history or legal history. We always come to you. So, John, welcome back for another.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So we were going to talk about the High Council, but I think I want to ask you to talk more about the police structure, because the more I think about it, the more I think this is going to be germane to the story, especially as we get into the Utah period. I'm knee deep in some research for Utah period right now. And wow, if Hosea Stout and those police don't keep showing up everywhere in all the things. So why don't we get into it? Help us understand why we're going to be talking about the police structure and how, you know, when you think of Mormon pioneers camping out there in the cold at winter quarters, we don't think about justice. We don't think about police. We don't think about our ancestors getting into trouble, fighting with each other, arguing, lots of problems with cows, lots of animals getting mad at each other. So why don't we get into it?
Perfect. So we can't really understand winter quarters without going back and talking about Nauvoo. In Nauvoo, the Saints were able to set up their very own legal system and their sort of view of criminal justice. But prior to the Nauvoo Charter, the High Council, with William Marks at its head, acted as both a legislature and a criminal court.
Ah, yes. Back to the good old days when the High Council would pass laws, like setting the salary of the ferryman, the guy that ran the ferry back and forth, setting the wages of the clerk, building a boarding house, building a school, appointing a butcher, setting prices for beef and pork, really important stuff there, and running, of course, a printing office. That can't go wrong. Growing up, my state didn't have a ferryman. Did yours, Brian?
Just going to say, what kind of boring, crappy vanilla state did you didn't even have a ferryman? You just let people ferry across the river with no rules? Weird.
It's probably because the High Council of my ward is made up of all dentists now. Got to support your family.
Dentist, insurance salesman, maybe you have an occasional magician just to spice things up, just to be a little different.
You and did not have a magician on your High Council. High Councilmen are not that interesting.
Oh, wait till you see my High Council. Ferrymen and High Councilmen, that's, you know, and magicians, that's all we do around there. So. And it's interesting because back in the Nauvoo period, these guys were also acting as a criminal court. So they're handing down sentences or, you know, disfellowshipping you from the church. You know, people would injure the ferry. They would let animals eat their neighbor's crops. And then if you really had fun, you had cases dealing with slander. One of them that's really fun is when Oliver Walker claimed the church authorized theft. The complaint stated, quote, that in the church at Nauvoo, there did exist a set of pilferers who were actually thieving, robbing, plundering, taking and unlawfully carrying away from Missouri certain goods and chattels, wares and property, and that the act and acts of such supposing thieving, etc., was fostered and conducted by the knowledge and approbation of the heads and leaders of the church by the presidency and High Council.
They also didn't really have a way to conflict cases back then, so it didn't go great for Brother Walker when the group that you slandered was the same group that was deciding whether you slandered them. The High Council would also act like a civil court and mediate people's disputes. But then we got the Nauvoo Charter, which formed an actual government who could pass city ordinances, set up a court system, and granted them the power to set up a police force.
So we've had you on to talk about the court system before, but tell us about the police force, and please send them over, because if you can hear in the background, I've got like a bajillion kids out there and we need some law and order in this household.
And the police force there, it's not the Nauvoo Legion, right? It does its own thing.
Yeah, right. So the Nauvoo Charter allowed for Nauvoo to appoint a marshal, which they did almost immediately. It also allowed the city council to appoint constables, one for each ward.
Wards. Okay. I don't think most Mormons know that when they refer to wards now, like in modern times, that it comes from political wards in Nauvoo. And because I didn't know that either. Like, it's just something that we call our congregation. That's what I'm used to. But originally it was the Nauvoo first through fourth wards, but it was all political and not church related, which surprises me.
I want to make a joke about how wards are still political groups, but I'm not going to do it. It's too easy. Just not
going to. Apparently yours has a magician. So
we have magicians and ferrymen. Don't forget.
and ferryman.
It is too easy. So the marshal and the constables also implemented a night watch. And those guys were sort of the thugs. They later picked on William Marks and William Law. And so this police force grew. And as it grew, by January 1843, there were 16 men under the direction of police captain Jonathan Dunham. And this grew even further to where eventually Hosea Stout rose to the top law enforcement official in Nauvoo and then later winter quarters.
Perfect. Good. Yeah, let's move on to winter quarters now. How did that get set up there?
Well, before we get to that, we need to understand just where winter quarters is.
It's in Nebraska, Cornhusker State. Go Huskers.
Okay, that's rude because Dinger's in the room and he only knows about potatoes, so I'm not sure he'd understand.
All right. So winter quarters was not in Nebraska, and that's important. Everybody's probably scratching their heads right now, but winter quarters was in the unorganized territory or Indian territory, a land that was owned by the United States, but didn't have a formal legal structure.
By legal structures and laws, do you mean basically screw over all the Native Americans every chance you get every time?
Sadly, yes, that was the legal structure there in the territories at the time. So when the Saints were in winter quarters, they were in the territories and not any that were organized. So in 1854, the area that is now Nebraska was formed into the Nebraska Territory out of that unorganized state, meaning that the United States Congress passed an organic act allowing them to form a sort of government. With most positions being appointed by the feds. And so when they grew enough, they could then petition to become a state. And so Nebraska got that honor in 1867. But the important part is that under and in the unorganized territory, there wasn't a real legal structure to function under. They were technically in the jurisdiction of the Indian Agency at Council Bluffs, and that agency was not equipped to deal with a large body of white people. Thus, the Saints had to sort of come up with their own.
And this doesn't apply just to Nebraska, obviously. Once we make it to Utah, we'll see how important it was to become a territory, and then obviously, more importantly, a state. And that desire to become a state, ultimately, is behind so much of what goes on. And because we would be remiss in not mentioning this, it's behind the manifesto, for example. So the quote-unquote
end. You just took my joke. You took my joke. Yes. I was going to make a joke about being so important that they gave up polygamy. They laid it on the altar of sacrifice, but fine.
Excellent podcast minds think alike.
So Buchanan's law is every time we make something about the FLDS, but Brian's law is every time we make something about the manifesto. So here we go.
Any rate, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Dinger, get us back to the unorganized territories here.
All right. So by the summer of 1846, the Saints were spread over Iowa, which was a territory until December 28th, 1846, and winter quarters with the main body of Saints being at winter quarters.
Yeah. And Juanita Brooks, who I know a little bit about, estimated that in 1846, there were about 3,500 people that were there, 757 men and 2,736 women and children. It's like what heaven's going to look like, right? And there were around 2,500 spread throughout Iowa as well.
Yeah, so we have this large group of people who need a legal system and a criminal justice system, but they're on the frontier. And so I want to point people to two amazing sources to read if you have an interest in this. The first is a thesis by Jeremy Parkin called Police Work on the Mormon Trail, 1846 to 1847. And then you have a book by one of the greatest Western legal historians there is, John Philip Reed, called Policing the Elephant. And they argue for a sort of makeshift police force, people applying and bringing Eastern political principles to the West, where they kind of moved from an urban policing to a more rural one. And so in Parkin's work on Mormon policing at winter quarters, he argues that this starts at Nauvoo. When the Nauvoo Charter was repealed, Hosea Stout's police force didn't disband, but shifted from being under civil authority to ecclesiastical authority. And once forced out of Nauvoo, the police officers and other recruits formed into sort of a night watch, which protected the camps and those traveling across Iowa.
All right. And then so then what happens when all these guys get to winter quarters and set up there?
All right. So in winter quarters, they formed back into more of a typical police force. And this was done under the authority of the Army of Israel. So it was sort of a paramilitary police force where Hosea Stout was selected to preside over a city guard.
I feel like since you said Hosea Stout that I need to jump in because I've seen this in his journal and I love reading Hosea Stout's stuff because it's bananas. So let me read it. He says, quote, "You are hereby required and commanded to keep up a city guard as follows. Firstly, the guard must put on duty at or before 8 o'clock in the evening and not released until the people are generally up in the morning. Secondly, to keep on duty 4 men at a time, each man to remain on duty one half the night. Thirdly, to post 2 men on the north and 2 on the south of the public or council lot. Fourthly, their duty shall be to guard the city against fires or any incident which may happen to occur to interrupt the peace or destroy the property of citizens. Fifthly, to make report hereto to me in writing when all men under your command shall have done each one tour of duty, noting the names of the persons who does duty and the time when it is done." It's weird. He didn't say anything about stealing people's alcohol, but that should be in there.
That's in the amendment to the and that's, see, that all that is very interesting because you can see they're not really a normal police force. They're just guards for the city.
Yeah, that's right. But it ended up not working because they were having problems inside the city. Originally, they thought it was going to be pressures and crime from outside, whether bandits or Native Americans, but they found that they needed to police themselves. And so while this was first under the Army of Israel, it soon got switched over and they became under the jurisdiction of the Municipal High Council. So the Winter Quarters Municipal High Council. So by October 1846, the High Council took over and ordered Stephen Markham to, quote, put out a guard of not less than 50 men to, quote, guard the city against the Indians now in town. And they also ordered Markham and not Stout to do this because Stout was also made the High Council's clerk.
Oh, it sounds like sweet baby Hosea Stout got demoted or fired.
Yeah, but if he did, it didn't last because Brigham Young eventually rolled into town and decided that winter quarters needed a formal police force. This is where it switched over. So Brigham Young told the High Council to establish a regular standing police. And so a committee of 3, which was Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, as well as former police captain Hosea Stout, got together to form a police force. So the committee produced a list of new policemen that they could trust, and Hosea Stout was unanimously voted as captain. So he got his old job back. And this police force reported to the Municipal High Council, which was a sort of civil government all wrapped up into one body, with some ecclesiastical duties in the mix. So according to Stout, the Municipal High Council, quote, endowed with all the powers of a high council of the church and also the powers of common council of a municipality, close quote. So the High Council was both a high council, but then also the executive, legislative, and judicial branch in the Latter-day Saint community. And they all reported to Brigham Young.
Okay, hold on though, because earlier talking about branches of government and you said that they were in an area where there really wasn't any. So can you help me understand what's happening, what's going on there?
All right, so you're right. This is all just sort of illusory. The only power they have is the power that the people are willing to cede to them. And so they only had jurisdiction over those who let them.
Fair enough then. So speaking of the High Council and the police force, where was their actual jurisdiction?
So in the beginning, it was just the formal borders of winter quarters, but the High Council would expand it from time to time. There wasn't a lot going on the Iowa side of the river, but those in Iowa did cede that ecclesiastical jurisdiction to the High Council. For example, one time, the High Council ordered Hosea Stout to go to the Iowa side and to seize some disputed property. So he did this. He crossed over into the state and then later reported back his actions to the council. And so what's amazing to me is at the time that he did this, Iowa had actually become a state. And so these actions, in my opinion, are highly illegal.
Brian's face. What? Highly illegal? Not on our High Council. Not with our magicians and ferrymen.
Not with Hosea Stout ever. No, that's definitely never going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So what else did the High Council do then?
All right. So they acted like a government. They formed committees, settled disputes, passed laws, and acted as the governing authority for both temporal and spiritual things. They acted as the judiciary, but also let bishops handle things. And so in those cases where they allowed the bishop to handle disputes, they served as an appellate court, hearing appeals made from the bishop's court. And so Kimball and Godfrey, who you already talked about, argued that the High Council, quote, sought resolution of disputes more than adjudication of right and wrong. And so people looked to the High Council for direction, justice, and resolution.
Well, this is all sounding very kind of organized by this point. Well, these guys on the police force, did they get paid?
Sort of, or at least they were supposed to.
No, because we operate from an unpaid clergy, John Dinger. I've heard that said many times.
Ah, that's right. I'm not being honest, but let me go on. They did or they were supposed to. The High Council paid each officer 75 cents a shift, and Stout was paid 75 cents a day. However, like many governments, they had money problems. The taxes that they levied to pay for the police force amounted to about $761, but that didn't cover the police budget.
So they're basically like a government if they're out there collecting taxes.
Yeah, but they weren't very good at it. Or then again, maybe they were. Brigham Young told the High Council to use good judgment. He noted that sometimes certain people should be exempt from taxes. He said, in certain cases, you may lawfully be free from. For instance, some woman may come to the stray pen and find her cow. Her husband is in the army. Let the cow go. We are an oppressed people, and we ought to forbear with one another and be as careful of oppressing one another as we can.
See, who says we can't say nice things about Brigham from time to time? Huh? He still doesn't have game, and there's a lot of persecution in there. But he brought in a cow, so we will allow it. So do you have any examples of how all of this like worked together, and does it involve more cows?
Yes and yes. So one instance there in winter quarters was when police officers William Meeks and Elias Gardner had to go and apprehend an ox belonging to Henry Bully. So Bully's ox had damaged Phineas Richard's garden, and the police went to catch it and then put it in the town pen. And it looked like it might turn violent when Bully and his son, who according to Stout, quote, attempted to rescue the ox by violence. The officers defended themselves. So Stout recorded, quote, when they came in a violent, menacing way, Gardner and Meeks drew a pistol and presented it to them and notified them to stand back. And if anything was wrong, to go to the council. Close quote. So while rare, the police did have to draw their weapons from time to time. In this case, Bally and his son backed down, but continued to insult and threaten the officers. The ox was taken, and the police arrested Bally's son. He was taken before the bishop and tried for threatening an officer and ended up being fined $5.
I have to say that sounds extremely frontier to me. You know, presenting a gun over livestock. That's about as frontier as it gets.
I agree. So that's kind of what we have, right? We have these Eastern police methods kind of crashing into the frontier, like we talked about, trying to be a proper Eastern police force, but dealing with those rural attitudes. But just like today, as you kind of see here, not everybody likes the police.
That's what's so funny to me is they don't like the police, even though it's their own. And like, why wouldn't you like Hosea Stout coming in and cracking skulls and stealing your liquor? I don't know what's not to like about that. They back the blue there. But I think Stout even records in his journal, quote, some here have a great objection to police. Yeah, wonder why.
Yeah, but the High Council would usually back them up. At a trial where a witness said Stout was too hasty, Councilman Phineas Richards defended Stout. He said, quote, the police was trampled on in the discharge of their duty. And another councilman there, George W. Harris, agreed and explained that, quote, there is always a way to come at redress of grievances without rising up in violence against authorities. And so there you have it, a sort of government that did everything, taxes, police, was the court, heard appeals, all of that, all under ecclesiastical authority, which answered to Brigham Young and the 12. And just as we had to kind of look at Nauvoo and the governing there, which led to winter quarters, we really need to look at winter quarters and their sort of ecclesiastical pseudo-government with police and taxes and all of that, because it really helps us later understand governing in Utah.
Can I ask you a few questions about this?
Yes.
So are the police basically called by Brigham then?
Well, as you saw it, yeah, that committee of three got together and made the list of people who they thought they could trust, and then offered them the job, I guess, if you will, or sort of the assignment. And so, yes.
This is what's so fun to me about Mormon history, because especially as we get into the Utah period, where it really is just Mormon villages operating within their own, everyone's Mormon. So you have the same human problems that you have everywhere else. There's people that break rules and people that have domestic, you know, disputes and violence, and the police are needed, but they're guys that your ward called, like they called the ward janitor, or like, who's really good at cracking skulls here? That guy, we're going to call him to that. And it's such a funny idea for me to think about, like, Brigham at the end of the day is like dad and mom coming home, and the police are like the older sister in charge of the kids. You know, they're like trying to keep those wily Mormons from getting into trouble. And then they'll complain to mom and dad, and whatever Brigham says goes. And there's this like weird tension where the police are in charge, but at the end of the day, it's what Brigham says goes.
Right. And if you remember how we talked about on our little mini series podcast, Deseret Dramas, how the probate judges in Utah were the bishops. So they may have been qualified to be a bishop, right? But now all of a sudden they are making legal decisions for all of Utah. And again, they're all under the jurisdiction of Brigham Young as well.
Untrained clergy, never been a problem in Mormonism. We've never had problems with that before. It does really go back to this, though. Like, I'm glad that you brought this up, that wards were political, because that we're still dealing with the remnants of that in the sort of spiritual, religious, community-based context now in modern days. And it really is left over from this political stuff, where that's why we do have bishops who don't have training in social work now doing the work of social workers. Because like you said, they were judges. They were the legal, you know, the organization, the religious structures that Mormons go to church with are frontier police structures in the Wild West. That's so crazy to think about. Makes church more interesting. Unless you have a magician in your high council, and then maybe.
I still don't believe it. It's all dentists and insurance salesmen.
I knew a guy that did blinds. Does that count? Put really good blinds on your windows.
He was the token blue collar guy.
Yeah, that's right. One of us, one of the people. Well, thanks, Dinger. Brian, anything else you want to say before we wrap it up?
Just quickly, I think this is one expression of be careful what you wish for. Because the thought had been, especially toward the end of Nauvoo, I mean, and this had been in the mix for a long time, is we're being oppressed, our rights are being trampled. If only we could be by ourselves and set up our own government, then everything would be great. And we're seeing slight ripples already that it's not quite that easy. And then it also speaks to, you know, when you then are in charge and you do have the power, are you going to oppress and trample rights? So we'll see that kind of shift in power dynamics that starts in winter quarters and obviously will magnify in Utah.
Brian, if you don't like it, you can go join James Emmett out there in the wilderness. I heard he does shower.
I like shoes, I like eating, and I like my wife. I'm keeping all of those things.
Well, thanks again, Dinger, for taking time out of your busy schedule, cracking skulls up there in Idaho. Whatever it is you do in your day-to-day fancy criminal justice system. I do think Idaho is still the Wild West.
It can be, sadly.
Well, thanks again. Do you want to tell us about, can we talk about your project you're working on or not yet?
Ooh, which one?
The one with Cheryl.
Oh, I don't know if I can or not, but I guess I will. We have finished a draft and actually submitted our William Marks book. So we hope to see it by the end of the year in print.
It's about 6 months too late for this podcast, but we'll have you come back on to talk about it.
I'm going to keep you to that. Thank you. We'll be right back.
I've been working with some fancy schmancy Hollywood types on several projects, including a Western, and I keep telling these writers, remember, the Mormons in the Wild West are similar to everyone else. Your Deadwoods, Lonesome Doves, your McClintocks, your Grant Stoddards, all of it. They were rough, ruthless, and hardcore, except the difference is your legal system isn't a sheriff, it's a bishop. When you get into legal trouble, you aren't always rounded up by the desperados in a range war. The range war instead is with soldiers and Gentiles against the Mormons. It's really fascinating.
So now that Dinger has laid out all the legal structure for us, let's get into some of the fun stuff. Let's talk about the police. In winter quarters, there was a regular standing police of about 20 dudes, and Hosea Stout was assigned as their captain. According to Kimball and Godfrey, each night the police would break it up into several shifts. 5 men would patrol the camp at night and then 5 during the day. When nearby raids by starving indigenous neighbors took place, the police would ride out as a posse and reclaim the missing livestock.
So what were the issues police usually dealt with in the camp? The big one, and I know this will be shocking to Mormons now, but it was drunkenness. And in a move that would have a lot of Mormons clutching their neckties, it was the ward bishop in winter quarters who issued alcohol to their camps. It was actually an early form of fast offering, so consider this law in winter quarters, quote, only bishops could sell liquor in winter quarters and only to those who could afford it without hardship to their families. The profits would be used to aid the poor. That's the kind of fast offerings I think a lot of Mormons would sign up for.
I imagine you'd get a lot better participation by teachers if that were part of the deal. Yes,
especially around February, January, February, Super Bowl Sunday.
The idea probably started as a way to reduce drunkenness because a lot of rowdiness and fights broke out, and of course, alcohol was involved. This is your friendly periodic reminder that water at this time was gross squared. Good old-fashioned moonshine was less likely to kill you than a glass of water. But there's also all sorts of other crimes, and the most pesky one involved animals getting outside their pens. There's also legitimate accidents from wagons and animals, animals going missing, violations in the camp. The biggest issue that pissed people off the most was stray animals.
I'm sorry, I know we're going on like 4 episodes in a row, but I have to invoke Buchanan's Law again.
I just enjoy how you've named it Buchanan's Law, because you're the one that always brings up the FLDS, not me.
That's why I got to name it. And really, I'm just trying to make everyone use it now, that whenever you bring up the FLDS in conjunction with Joseph Smith or Mormonism, it's Buchanan's Law. Everyone, please practice. Take it to Twitter. Take it to your social media feeds. Put it in your publishing. You can cite Brian as a footnote. Please make this happen. Thank you. Okay, back to Buchanan's Law. So I've talked many times about my work with different fundamentalist groups, and I really like rural communities, but Shore Creek is its own wild ride. It's so fun because you'll go down there, and still to this day, if you've been in a rural community, you know the problem of stray animals is a big one. And we've had, I can't go into details, but I'll just say there has been a long-standing issue between 2 friends of ours over their stray animals getting into each other's yards. It's going on like a decade now of warring, and they're like best friends, but they're always suing each other for their animals getting into each other's pens. And if you get on the community pages, there's always some stray animal, some stray like llama eating someone's crops, or someone's cow is wandering down Main Street. This is a real problem in rural communities, and I just think it's funny. That was a good use of Buchanan's Law, yes?
I suppose. Petition to compromise and name it Rossetti's Law?
Petition denied. However, Rossetti's Law refers to whenever we bring up Joseph Musser in any conversation.
Okay.
Use it, people. Take it to Twitter.
That's fair. I can live with that. Okay. Let's get into some of the crazy stories in the Kimball and Godfrey article. This article talks about instances of crime in winter quarters and how the Mormon structure of government dealt with it. First, the police. So, if Hosea Stout's your leader, you can imagine that's going to create some craziness. We've talked plenty about good old Hosea Stout before, but let's give you a little refresher so you can understand who the eminent chief of police is in winter quarters.
I want everyone to stop what you're doing and Google the guy. I don't care if you're running. I don't care if you're walking your dog. I don't care if you're
driving,
nursing your baby.
Whatever.
Driving your baby. Driving on the road, you pull over. There's a great rest stop in Fillmore. You can use it. It's great. Pull over.
Go to Scipio. You can see the zoo.
That's what I was thinking. The Scipio. The petting zoo in Scipio. Pull on over. And I want you to go to your browser and type in the letters H-O-S-E-A-S-T-O-U-T into the magic computer machine right now. Because as we talk about him, I want you to have the image of this, of his crazy eyes burning into your brain. You need to do this. We can't do this alone. He's one of those guys that has a murdery face. And no offense to his descendants, who I'm sure are lovely people, but your grandpa looks like he was quietly strangling a squirrel while he sat for his portrait.
Oh, do these nice people not have his face staring at them from their bookshelves? I'm not joking. His journals, edited by one Juanita Leon Levitt Pulsifer Brooks, has Stout's face on the dust jacket of both volumes. It goes together. It's like part of his face on each one. It's actually really impressive. Chris and I were discussing this at work. I would argue it is the greatest dust jacket in Mormon history.
Okay, wait, pause. I know we're making fun of Hosea Stout for a moment. We will return to his murdery mug, I promise. But Brian, you know when you've met a true Mormon bookseller nerd when they start arguing about dust jackets. It is like the bottom of the barrel of nerdiness for...
Top of the shelf is the way we...
Top of the dust jacket shelf. And Brian is a fanatic and he will tell you. What will you tell them about their dust jackets, Brian?
If you're going to throw them away, give them to me because that's where the value of your books is.
Dust jackets. It's wild. It's wild. I'm going to say this again. I've said this before. If you've watched Tiger King or Joe Exotic, what is it, Tiger King? They always say, like, don't mess with cat people. Cat people are crazy. And I always say the booksellers are the cat people of Mormonism. They're crazy. They're like arguing about dust jackets. Like, and I'm talking passionate articles about dust jackets. So anyway, sorry for the dust jacket detour.
I'm Don. I'm down in Puerto Rico. I'm still alive, just for the record. All right, let's leave the more important matters of dust jackets aside. Back to Hosea Stout.
And his murdery face.
His squirrel murdering face here.
Seriously, look at him. Stare into his eyes. You stare into his eyes and it's the abyss. Like there is like the truth of the universe, the dark truth of the universe behind those eyes.
I poisoned your grandpa. That's what he's saying to you. Stout was born into a very devout, very strict Quaker family in Kentucky in 1810. If you remember, his parents sent him to a Shaker school where he beat the crap out of any kid that challenged him. And remember, Quakers are supposed to be nonviolent, so his Quaker friends were shocked and horrified at his penchant for violence. His love for drawing first blood would become a theme for his life. And you know what? You go back to episode 47 if you want the details. I would actually definitely recommend revisiting episode 47 right after this one, because we're going to kind of regurgitate some of it in this one and tie some loose ends together.
What you need to know for the sake of this podcast is dude had a thirst for violence, and that made him the perfect candidate to join the Danites in Missouri. He rose through the ranks pretty quickly when it came to meting out justice onto anyone that tried to hurt Mormon leadership. And he became a trusted bodyguard for Joseph Smith and for other Quorum members. He was appointed chief of police in Nauvoo and made president of the 11th Quorum of the 70 and joined the secret cool kids Council of 50. But the thing that really set him apart was not the laying on of hands per se, but his love of poisoning people.
Yeah, everybody was kind of afraid of Mr. Squirrel Strangler Stout that he was going to poison them. If you'll remember, several Smith family members believed that Hosea Stout poisoned Joseph Smith's younger brother Samuel just a month after Joseph Smith was killed in Carthage. Then there's always the fun story that William Clayton had to get out of Nauvoo with 30 minutes' notice because he was convinced Stout was trying to poison him. Again, episode 47, we talk about all this.
When the Saints settled in Winter Quarter, Stout would stay there for about 2 years, keeping law and order. Which is such an interesting choice because Stout seemed to love the calling as captain of the police force, but it seemed that everyone else, including Brigham Young, weren't so sure about Stout's ability to do it. Let's just say his bedside manner lacked a little bit. It wasn't long before Stout started abusing his power, and we should say he did similar antics in Nauvoo as well, but it was a lot more noticeable in a police force of 20 people.
The regular standing police in Winter Quarters were a rowdy group. usually getting sauced up on the whiskey before heading out on their rounds. They'd get drunk and then just kind of threaten anyone they didn't like. Apparently, this got to be such an issue that the Brethren had to police the police. Now, before Alpheus Cutler defects and does his own thing, he's in winter quarters, acting as the High Council President. The Council votes for him to, quote, labor with Stout concerning his overbearing spirit.
Isn't that the most, like, Mormon passive-aggressive language? Like, his overbearing spirit. Oh, you mean the time when he pulls a guy out of his tent and beats the crap out of him? It's a little overbearing there, Stout. Tone it down just a little bit. Apparently, Brigham Young, who had a lot of tolerance for these sort of antics, was even concerned. So you know it had to have been getting out of control if even Brigham was like, dude, you gotta settle it down. Wilford Woodruff's journal records deep worries from Young and others about Stout's boys, remember we talk about boys, taking things a little too far. In episode 46, we talk about the Bohois and how they'd hold kangaroo courts for one another, fine each other for things, especially the liquor.
I love that mock trials, probably not with Jay Reinhold, were such a common form of entertainment. I can't wait till we get on the trail so I can tell my favorite one. Soon, people. Soon.
Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been for love. Never would have called the train to Louisiana if it hadn't been for love. Never would have run through the blinding rain.
Here are some other examples of that from Kimball and Godfrey's article that we mentioned in episode 47. Quote, Stout was allowed a pint for trying to catch his horse, but fined a quarter for getting thrown off. The group also had sport at the expense of brother Isaac C. Haight, hoax Martindale for wearing the crown of Balaam, and had Langley tried tonight a woolly store for not holding the truth sacred, as we called it, and fined Woolly 1 gallon all in fun. The fines were invariably paid in liquor, and Stout reports being sick with headache in the mornings with suspicious regularity. When they found a hidden jug of whiskey, they simply confiscated it. Possession of liquor was not illegal, but Stout believed the jug was one, which the bee had hid out to glut their brutish appetites with, acting at the same time with as much contempt as they could towards the guard who were close by, end quote.
Even though Brigham Young might have had to wade through complaints about this sorts of behavior, it seems he did what the Quorum of the Twelve would get pretty good at, sanctioning things privately that he would otherwise be against publicly.
One fun thing about winter quarters, though, is it was hard to do things privately. Stout's journals, as well as John D. Lee's, are such good sources for this time, and the articles we keep referencing refers to them a bunch and only talks about a fraction of the good stuff therein. One thing completely unrelated to extra legal justice, but I don't want to get it lost, is that Hosea Stout claims that on June 13th, 1846, Orson Hyde comes into camp and gives a sermon on the law of adoption. And the reason that this is pretty remarkable is because, as Stout says it, it was the first sermon he'd ever heard spoken publicly on the subject. And you do have recordings of adoption sealings happening throughout winter quarters.
Put myself behind a jailhouse door if it hadn't been, if it hadn't been for love. If it hadn't been, if it hadn't been for love. If it hadn't been for love.
Let's talk about flogging now, shall we? It might have been a sign of the times, but it seems that one of Brigham Young's favorite ways to punish people was to whip the crap out of them. This practice picks up in winter quarters and really flourishes in the Utah period under his reign. And before anyone says it's just a sign of the times, consider that flogging was a general military practice in the early 19th century. By the 1840s, a huge public movement swept the national discourse to end flogging. It was associated with enslavement and convicted criminals and was pretty humiliating to anyone who received it. Spurred by its use in the United States Navy, in 1849 the U.S. Senate received over 270 petitions to end the practice, and it was abolished in the Navy the following year, and eventually in all military practice by 1861, but somehow Brigham Young never got the memo on it.
Let's give you an example of Brigham Young's doublespeak here on the flogging issue. In the early days of winter quarters, there were three young men who faced an allegation of sexual misconduct of some sort, and they were severely flogged by Stout and his men. Brigham Young would eventually defend the punishment publicly, but claim he didn't know about it until after it had already happened. Godfrey and Kimball argue that Brigham Young took this tactic of letting people in winter quarters believe that the police were just naughty enough, near vigilante, as they called it, as a way to instill fear and to incentivize people to follow the rules. Like, I don't know, maybe the police are a little crazy and corrupt. If I'm not here, who knows what's going to happen? Because if they believe the police were just a little crazy and a bit outside the law, perhaps that would incentivize people to behave.
Then Hosea Stout just got fined 2 quarts. I wouldn't mess with him.
You know how he gets when he gets sauced up. Likes to flog.
Joseph Fielding's thoughts seem to kind of back that up. Quote, "It is plain that nothing but the strictest laws enforced with what some call rigor, altogether considered by many in the camp oppressive, and has been a source of much evil and hard feeling. Yet if we had not had such laws, a great part of our corn, etc., would have been destroyed. Some of the police would at times give way to passion and would swear like blackguards. I have heard them called their brethren damned infernal liars, etc. The office of policeman is no desirable one. If there be any rough ones, they have to deal with them, and they are likely enough to be rough too."
Stout liked to beat you if you were too loud. He liked to beat you if you broke the rules. He liked to beat you if you let your animals go loose. Henry Phelps, for example, got what they called a severe caning when he was trying to recover a stray animal. And in an example that backs up what Brian has just said, one time there was a petty thief named James Tremaine who the police dragged away after a suspected crime. They made James think they were going to murder him, but at the last second let him go if he promised to leave town and never return. And he did.
Good choice, Jim. If you think that's okay, consider the practice of tithing. In today's era, you get to pay your tithing and you go settle with your bishop. If you don't pay it, the worst thing that happens is you don't get your temple recommend, you don't get to go to your kid's wedding in the temple. But back then, the police would make you pay your tithing.
According to Kimball in Godfrey's article, quote, "When Joseph Francis declined to pay tithing because he considered supporting a relative's children an adequate substitute, the High Council refused to accept this excuse and ordered him either to work one day in 10 or to pay the cash equivalent."
At this point, tithing becomes a necessary part of communal living in the eyes of church leadership. Consider it the tax that helped pay the salaries of the very police forcing you to pay your tithing. Something had to fund their salaries, and fake beer taxes weren't going to be the only thing to do it.
Sometimes you get what could be seen as, I don't know, a softer side of Hosea Stout. If you were his friend, he seemed to be a little more lenient with you. One time, someone Stout seemed sympathetic to was a man named Joseph Herring. And Herring was a Mohawk man that had converted to Mormonism. He and his brother George became friends with Hosea Stout back in Nauvoo. And apparently their indigeneity helped the Mormons when they settled in Potawatomi land. Joseph Herring was adopted into the tribe and was a good go-between. But something happened between Joseph Herring and Wilford Woodruff. We aren't sure what, but it was bad enough to cause a huge problem.
One night, Herring gets really intoxicated and threatened to kill Wilford Woodruff. For his part, Woodruff seems to maybe had a guilty conscience because his journals report having dreams that he was going to be killed by Indians. He actually has 2 different dreams on different occasions that this would happen.
What's interesting is that Mormons were strictly instructed to not kill Indians while squatting on their land. Doing so would cause a lot more problems with the federal government than Brigham wanted to deal with. There were some cases of flogging Indians who stole, but usually it was something Brigham wanted to avoid. So Jacob Weatherby was said to be the only Mormon killed by Indians at winter quarters. But of course, the death count was a little lopsided. Famous destroying angel Bill Hickman would later brag in his memoir about killing several Indians at winter quarters and hiding their bodies. According to Brigham's law, if white men killed an Indian, he would be turned over to the local tribe, but of course this didn't happen to Hickman. Put a pin in Bill Hickman because we will be coming back to him in a second.
Nobody puts a pin in Bill Hickman.
Just stay away from Bill Hickman. Don't put pins in him. Speaking Don't put needles in him.
Crazy eyes. Yeah, stay away from that, dude. Okay. Let's go back to the story of the Mohawk Mormon, Joseph Herring. He first shows up in Woodruff's journal in January 1847, and it's clear that Wilford is concerned about him because he writes about him only in shorthand. Sadly, he only mentions Herring twice, and the second time he comes up, there's a couple words in shorthand that even Lejean Carruth couldn't figure out. Very curious. Apparently he got upset, he threatens to kill Woodruff, and it's clear he's not going to follow the 12. Hosea Stout reported the threat to leadership. Godfrey and Kimball write, quote, "Stout perceived the threat as genuine and reported it to the 12. The next day, Herring also got into a dispute with John H. Blazard and tried to stab him, but the police intervened. No effort was made to prosecute him. That night, he slept off his intoxication at Hosea Stout's home and left town the next day. A week later, Herring was back, again drunk and threatening Woodruff. Stout again gave him a bed, but this time Herring was excommunicated. He left town and later reiterated his threats in a letter. When he returned to winter quarters after more than a year, an unidentified assailant killed him.
An unidentified assailant, huh? Try again. A footnote in Godfrey's article includes this gem, quote, "The 12 agreed that Herring, with the law of the Lord to be administered in righteousness," meaning probably that he should be killed before he could kill Woodruff. And I want to talk about the law of the Lord. The law of the Lord becomes code word for killing. And one of the worst things about this sort of code word, the law of the Lord, it gets used throughout Mormonism up until the 2000 teens, when Irva LeBaron's group is using this language, the law of the Lord, to mean murder. So Herring was probably killed after the Beehoys got after him and couldn't catch him, so Bill Hickman is sent out to get him instead.
Jump me, Alice Angel fail.
Yeah, let's go back to that idea for just a minute. Quote, "The law of the Lord to be administered in righteousness." Because somewhere, deep, deep in the depths of hell, LeBaron's ears just perked up a little bit. This is his game. Because this is code for the Mormon death penalty. And this is the fetus of early blood atonement doctrine. Now remember, in winter quarters, there's no jail. This is not an organized town, so Mormons likely saw that the threat of justice had to be extra harsh to keep people in line. This phrase, the law of the Lord, starts to become code with the threat of death. You don't do what we say, and the law of the Lord will have to come upon you. Like the murder of Joseph Herring, the law of the Lord won out, and he was ultimately killed, like we said, more than likely by Bill Hickman.
Yeah, because it becomes a sort of shadowy threat that basically said, if man's justice doesn't do the job, God's will. And God's justice is death. And this is the reasoning that eventually becomes blood atonement. So there becomes theological underpinnings when Brigham decides to couple it with Christian ideas of atonement. There are some sins so bad that even the blood of Christ can't help them, so the law of the Lord must step up instead. Hint, hint, you must shed your own blood because Christ's blood isn't strong enough for what you've just done. And that's how, kids, you get a blood atonement.
We see the shades of gray in the integrity of early saints who are poor and starving. Take our main guy, W.W. Phelps, for example. He's low on funds, he happens to let one of his animals stray. Stray animals in winter quarters meant a fine. So Phelps lied about it to avoid having to pay the fee. Apparently, in the fiasco, he not only lied, but also insulted an officer, Lumen Calkins.
William Wines Phelps, man, he was a little shenanigan maker. He was always causing problems. Calkins, in turn, sued Phelps for the debt, and he did. Even in Juanita Brooks's notes from Hosea Stout's diary, apparently Phelps' son tried to wrestle the horse out of the stray cage, either to get rid of the evidence or to get the horse back in, and Stout caned him so hard with a hickory rod that he broke it against the boy's back.
If you're looking at the biggest headaches, or in this case, backaches in winter quarters, it's frequently around stray animals. If it seems innocuous enough to you and I, well, this is one of those things where 19th century values are very different than ours. Lindsay talked about her experiences with some ex-FLDS friends. Perhaps if you grew up in a really rural community, you can understand the frustration. But if you didn't, this might seem a little extreme. But stray animals could literally threaten starvation, disrupt crops, cause serious harm or accident, and so the winter quarters police took this very seriously.
There really were, like, these were animals that could crush children, you know, like people died sometimes. So it really was, it's weird to be like, oh, they're like caning the crap out of each other over a cow. But there, you know, this was a hard penalty because it was a big problem. And in another example from this article, and please just read the whole thing from the show notes, there are stories of duels almost being fought when someone's oxen is confiscated by the police for showing up in the public cornfield and eating the crops. When the man went to retrieve it from the police, it almost came to violence. After a fight over cattle being driven to the stray pen, Charles W. Patton charged policeman Hosea Stout and his brother Alan with abusive conduct, imagine that, towards Patton and his family as part of the same incident. Hiram Murdoch charged that Stout's unnecessary violence with a club had seriously injured Murdoch's arm. The Stouts asserted that they had acted in self-defense while performing their duty. Patton's complaint was amicably settled, but the council referred Murdoch's charge to Bishop Isaac Clark. Clark found that Stout had used excessive force and ordered him to pay a $3 fine and apologize to Murdoch. Stout appealed to the High Council, which concluded that he had acted within the scope of his duties, a decision Brigham Young later confirmed, end quote.
And this is just one of many conflicts with stray animals. Council notes and journals of the time go over this major crisis of animals getting out, and it caused major fights with neighbors. Death threats were frequently involved, and it caused a lot of mayhem.
Yeah. In John D. Lee's clerking journals of the time, he mentions a lot of these conflicts, one that happened with Jace M. Hemick, who challenged Wilbur J. Earle to a duel for some unknown reason. Hemick wasn't punished above being moved to a different camp upstream. He apologized and swore his fealty to the Saints, and apparently that settled it.
Loyalty starts to become even more important value during this time. There's instances where, for example, where Lemuel Lewis was fined $5 for complaining about the Brethren. There are several instances of people being fined a lot of money, even up to potentially $100, for whining or talking smack about their priesthood leaders.
Another thing that the High Council dealt with was the relationship and divorce stuff. So remember that we keep teasing W.W. Phelps for being excommunicated a bunch? One of these happens in winter quarters. So Phelps is off on a mission in the East, and while there, decides to get a few ladies sealed to him in the eternal order of marriage. He marries three women as plural wives and starts sleeping with them. When he returns home to WQ, Brigham isn't thrilled he wasn't consulted on the marriages and argues that the man who performed the sealings, another Mormon elder, Henry B. Jacobs, didn't have the authority to do it. Now remember, he was married to Zina Huntington, and she had been married to Joseph Smith as a plural wife.
So if you remember, Henry Jacobs had been married to Zina Huntington, and she had been married to Joseph Smith as a plural wife. So that's one of those polyandrous situations. So Jacobs is well aware of the fluidity and squishiness of polygamy.
So he does something squishy himself. He marries William Wines Phelps to three ladies without Brigham Young's permission. Young reportedly said about the incident on November 28, 1847, quote, "If a man comes to me with a good spirit and willing to confess, I say I have done wrong. I'm willing to meet him halfway and more. Now this will do good, as Brother Phelps says. There are many looking for a hog hole to creep out by, and when they see that Brother Phelps can't creep out, they won't try. I ain't too big yet to creep out. Brother Phelps has done wrong, and I know it, and he knows it, and when he confesses, let it be dropped, let it pass and go along as if nothing had happened," end quote. Other than the fact that he's got three plural, new plural wives. No big deal.
The ladies are like, something may have happened.
Something, a few things, a few times. So Phelps is exed, but really it's a slap on the wrist, and Jacobs is silenced for performing the marriages. Of course, Phelps is rebaptized soon after, so don't worry for his eternal soul. He'll be writing hymns in your hymnals soon.
He'll get excommunicated next week. As a fun side note, she mentioned that Jacobs was silenced for his part in the sealings. Silencing priesthood is such an interesting term, was something they used to do. It was kind of like just putting your priesthood on pause for a bit. What is interesting is Community of Christ, formerly RLDS, still uses that practice. In LDS parlance, it's like a formal or kind of an informal probation.
We see Daniel Russell's name show up several times. He was a member of the 70 and probably a rapist. He was busted for lying about paying for his police fee. Then he was entangled. We're going to use the word entangled with a married woman. He claimed he was helping her leave a troubled marriage and to have her join him as a plural wife. But she must have felt differently because she and Russell's family produced evidence that a harm had been done. He may have been castrated as a result. And my take, it was a sexual assault of some sort. And at the time, Russell was already in another dispute over stolen horses.
The Kimball Godfrey article mentions, quote, three young men and two young women were accused of sexual immorality, but 13 months elapsed before there was another case involving sexual misconduct. I have heard of no report of adultery in this place since the affair last fall or summer with the three young men, Hosea Stout commented 5 months later. The following autumn, however, Daniel Russell, a member of the High Council who was already accused of violence and lying about a stray animal, was accused of, quote, some unbecoming things between him and a Sister Hart. Sister Hart and Russell's own family produced evidence. Russell confessed, apologized, and was already mentioned, was dropped from the council.
And then the footnotes of the article include this, quote, the three were non-Mormons, Daniel Barnum, Pelatiah Brown, and Jack Clothier. 18-year-old Sarah Brown and 17-year-old Caroline Barton were Wilford Woodruff's plural wives, and he divorced them, but they were not otherwise punished. And Russell may have been encouraging Sister Hart to leave her troubled marriage and become his plural wife. Brother Hart testified that if his wife had left him, he would rather she become Russell's plural wife than any other man. And this comes from the High Council, September 28, 1847.
And P.S. Wilford Woodruff was not real happy about what his young wives were doing. His young wives are like, we'd rather go have fun with, you know, people our own age than this old guy, so... And yeah, they just kind of are let out of the marriages, and that's that, and that's the end of it. Very fluid during this time. I'm not going to make a fluid joke. Nope. In Juanita Brooks' notes from the Hosea Stout diaries, Stout notes
you on... You meant poison.
Poison. Yes. Poison. That is the word I was looking for. August 31st, 1847, Daniel Russell had been counseled to confess humbly and then withdraw from the council. On the line below it, his notes read, on being closely pressed, he also declared him unqualified to sit in council, as he had lost his privy members and was a eunuch. He was dropped from the council.
Aunt Peggy privy members? That must be what they mean.
I suppose so.
Was a eunuch. Interesting. If it's a metaphor, he's literally equating his priesthood with his penis. If it's not a metaphor and he was castrated by some men in winter quarters, they are literally equating his penis with his priesthood. Either way, no fun.
This is another example of something that very much looks like Hebrew Bible kind of feel. And again, I can see Ervil LeBaron shaking his head in agreement. When things start to get very literal, very biblical, it tends to not end up great.
There were several instances in winter quarters of people getting a little too close with others that weren't married, and the High Council would have to deal with that. Benjamin Covey was convicted of practicing a wicked and abominable thing, of molesting two girls just under age 12.
That is not one of the seven habits of highly effective people in winter quarters.
No. And this is important, too, because, okay, this is in the 1840s, people are being convicted of pedophilia and molestation. So when we justify young girls being married, it was like, it's just the way that they did things. Not so fast. They knew it was wrong. Even the Mormons knew it was wrong. They were having courts about it. So Benjamin Covey was exed and his wife and children were released of any obligation to him. So again, just in case you thought marrying or sleeping with underage girls was something they did back then, it wasn't. When they found out that it happened, it was bad enough that people were punished for it.
I hear the crying of the hungry in the deserts where they're wandering. Hear them crying out.
Yes, there were lots of cases of petty thievery, stray animals, drunken disputes, domestic disputes, and all kinds of trouble you can imagine would happen camped out in the plains in the 19th century. But would you imagine a whore house in winter quarters? Why don't we ever hear that story?
The best little whorehouse in all of winter quarters. Wasn't that the Broadway play? But, like, how dare you? Because Mormons would argue for 3 decades that the act of polygamy saved their men and women from these kinds of vices. They were constantly yelling about how basically every non-Mormon dude had 17 mistresses, and that was just fine, but how dare we do polygamy? And, oh yeah, abortion too. Infanticide was this imagined horror that all non-polygamists were constantly involved in.
How does that explain then that the Mormons just down the river in the Garden Grove encampment were running a body house?
How's that again?
Oh yes, in the summer of 1847, just as Brigham Young and his entourage arrived in the Salt Lake Valley, the saints back in Garden Grove were going through something. Apparently, it shook up the whole community, and elders from the Council Bluffs had to go sort it out. But the story of prostitution and iniquity in Garden Grove will have to wait.
In the rubble of the towers, I hear leaders quit their lying. I hear babies quit their crying. I hear soldiers quit their dying, one and all. I hear them all, I hear them all.
You're going to go to the record store. You're going to give them all your money. Radio plays the Books of Mormon's report they want you to hear. Powered by Benchmark Books. So if you're like me, a combo plate at a restaurant is always tempting. Tonight, we're going to order up a number 6, article and book plate. First, the pièce de résistance, Law and Order in Winter Quarters, the article from BYU Studies written by Ken Godfrey and Ed Kimball. Very fantastic, really well researched, and it looks at just this slice of the craziness that's going on at the time. Now that you finished your article, you can dig into your book. It's another plug for Mormons at the Missouri by Richard Bennett. It's a really good treatment of this whole experience.
Destroying day nights, Brother Young. Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.